Hello and welcome to the official podcast of Palate Exposure, featuring Ilona Thompson, a podcast for those seeking the ultimate in wine, food, and travel. Each week, she interviews winemakers, chefs, celebrities, and a variety of guests that shape the way we enjoy life. This week, Ilona is excited to be sitting down with Colin Baker, the co-founder of Lock & Union.
Well, exciting indeed. I'm here with the co-founder of Lock & Union, a distillery located at the foot of famous Napa Valley. And in front of me are three beautiful bottles of gin.
We're drinking them too.
That's right. That's the pressure of the job. So one of them is the core product, which is an American dry gin. And then I'm also looking at a barley gin, which is one of the few opportunities I had to taste it. And there's a secret bottle that's been aged in Chardonnay barrels, from a famous winery. And we got to taste that as well. And I'll tell you, that was quite a revelation. So Colin Baker started Lock & Union. It's a relatively young company, but already quite storied and won many, many awards. So I am so excited to delve into the story of the company, which really unfolds in parallel with Colin's own story, which I found fascinating. And that's what I'd like to tackle next. I'd like for you to tell us where this idea came from and who you are and how this all happened.
Yeah, well, I figure, well, I always like to take it back to what I consider the beginning of this story, which was, several years ago, I was working as an accountant of all things, looking at it now,
wow.
what my career is. I was working as an accountant for a Big Four firm in Orange County, California, and it just was not for me. I absolutely hated my job. At the same time that I was developing this hatred for my job, I was getting obsessively into home brewing. Later on in life, I actually was glad that I was as miserable as I was, because if I wasn't that miserable, I wouldn't have taken the next step that I did. I was developing this love for home brewing and, decided to quit my job and was lucky enough to, get in contact with a guy in London, England, guy by the name of Duncan Sambrook, who also used to work for the same accounting firm that I did.
Mm-hmm.
And he had quit his job and opened a brewery in Battersea, South London. And so without any formal brewing experience at all, Duncan hired me for whatever reason. And I went over and worked for him for a while. And it was one of the best periods of time in my life, and that turned out to be, at the time, what I thought I was going to be doing long term, was working mm-hmm. in brewing, wherever that would be, hopefully in the UK. And so it got to the point where I needed a long term visa to live in the UK, live and work in the UK, and I wasn't going to marry somebody because, I could have, but I had a girlfriend at the time. Who was an American.
Could have been 90 Day Fiancé.
Yeah, exactly. But the only real practical way for me to get a long-term visa in the UK was to get a degree from a UK university.
Mm-hmm.
And so I started looking at places to go. Harriet Watt University stood out, because Harriet Watt University is one of the best brewing schools in the world.
Wow.
But it also turns out that it's brewing and distilling. Hmm. So I applied to Harriet Watt, was accepted into their master's program in brewing and distilling.
Mm-hmm.
And when I was there, I thought I was going to stay in brewing. As might happen when you're in Scotland, you fall in love with Scotch whiskey. And
naturally.
I ended up falling in love with distilling as a process, and on a plane flight home for winter break, it just came to me that I should switch focuses and get into distilling. And got off the plane, told my parents that that's what I was doing, and that's when this distillery was born. or the first seed of this idea was born.
Right.
And so then I went back and started designing stills with one of my professors there. That was the first piece of equipment that we had. I mean, this facility was always designed around the stills. Just kind of went from there. It's looking back now, it's kind of crazy that everything came to fruition the way it did.
I'm going to ask you in a second about this handy sketch that I'm looking at on the wall behind me of what the original still was drawn by you, but I want to go back for a second because you said something very insightful to me in the private conversation we had earlier about just to what degree you were dissatisfied. I just think it's such an important point because, you know, a lot of people are very good at their jobs, and I know you come from a long dynasty of people who are very successful in that profession.
Yeah.
So it was a logical pathway. And yet, at some point, what you described, almost like a low-grade depression, got so impactful.
If you want to be honest, it was almost more than that. Mm-hmm. And I'm okay admitting that.
Mm-hmm.
But at the end of the day, I'm really happy that I got as unhappy as I was. I know a lot of people who are mildly unhappy with the jobs, or moderately unhappy with the jobs that they have, and they just go forward with it because it's safe. It's hard to take, you know, that plunge and get into something else. And I was lucky enough to be early, enough on where I didn't have kids or other reasons why I couldn't up and, you know, change my life. I was unhappy enough to do something about it. And it was a risky move, certainly. It was like taking the safety net from under my life. I mean, the job that I had was, you know, safe, secure. I could stay in it long term and be just fine, but I would have been miserable. And so it was the best and worst thing that's ever happened to me. I'll put it that way, because otherwise I wouldn't have done this. I mean, I was not a huge risk taker. I think, you know, I got a master's degree in accounting, and I knew I didn't like accounting. I just didn't know what else to do, and I think it was kind of born out of, well, one, like I said, not knowing what I wanted to do, and also out of immaturity, you know, just not being willing to kind of be more introspective about my situation in life. But it kind of forced itself upon me, and I'm a different person than I was then because of that experience. I mean, it's serious. And I'm glad for that experience. So, you know, sometimes bad things can turn out to be good. In this case, it did. I haven't once regretted the decision to do that.
So here we are, an unlikely path to distilling.
Yeah.
That you could not have foreseen in any way, shape, or form. And yet you created a rather unique and very successful business. So I guess sometimes we experience adversity. And in the middle of it, it's hard to see, but having the benefit of the perspective, you expressing clearly some gratitude that it got, as you so eloquently put, this bad, that it pushed you in a different direction. So tell me the story behind the sketch and how your professor assessed the viability of this. And I know it ties to your name as well. So Lothianian.
So basically what I did is I went out and I looked at a bunch of different stills that were in the industry, you know, in Scotland already, and for distilleries that I like, Kilhoman was one of them, Ardbeg was one of them, and I kind of amalgamated them into one and did these sketches that were proportionally kind of a blend of them, put that together, to my professor and was like, well, will this work? And he said, well, yeah, this is brilliant. Go ahead.
Wow.
And then I asked him where I should get the stills built, and he said, Carl, hands down. And Carl is a still manufacturer in Germany. They're, I believe, the oldest still manufacturer in the world. There are a couple that are very close. Forsyth is one of them, which is the Scottish distiller. And really, Carl makes the best stills in the world. I mean, I came to know that, and a lot of it has to do with, if we're getting technical a little bit, their ability to weld copper to stainless and build steam jackets on the stills instead of
copper coils. You were describing this process as very difficult, highly skilled professionals that trained for decades.
Oh, yeah. The welders at Carl, it's 10 years before they even consider you for that kind of welding. And the reason is, I mean, copper is, the melting points of copper and stainless are so different. It's a very, very skilled thing to do. In fact, something that they have to, you know, sometimes happens with them is they get poached by some of the really, the welders get poached by some of the really big German manufacturers like Bosch, Mercedes, Porsche, those kind of people. But by and large, they stay there because they pay them well. Awesome company to work with. And they built an incredible set of stills. I mean, the equipment that we have here in some ways, you know, is unique. They treat this more or less like they're, well, not even more or less, this is their North American flagship. They haven't built another set of stills like this. And it's, you know, not just the stills themselves, but the control systems behind it, all the bells and whistles. We have so much control on that system. Mm-hmm. And that's, and I'll say it over and over and over again when we're talking about what we do. We always know what our inputs and outputs are for everything.
It's a state-of-the-art system, very smart, very elegant looking, by the way. I've seen quite a few stills, and I was instantly impressed when I walked in.
It's functional art.
It's large. It's a large-scale art, yes.
Yeah, it's a large setup, I mean.
Yeah, and my understanding is that not only it's unique, but the superior quality product is what drove this whole, that was the motivation behind it.
Oh yeah, absolutely. So yes, you have to know what you're doing to design like a gin recipe. We can get into how intricate that process was, but we couldn't make the product that we have without the stills that we have. I mean, the gin basket that we have. I mean, that's just one aspect of it, but every part of it, you know, little incremental changes add up to a lot. And so if you can't necessarily pin it down to one thing, the whole thing in its entirety makes a huge difference.
Well, you clearly are a man with a vision and have sort of a helicopter view of things. One of Colin's employees walked in right before the interview and he referred to him as Steve Jobs.
Oh, gosh.
Which is silly. So, yes, I must quote that because it was quite a compliment.
He hasn't ever told me that, actually. No, I'm not kidding. Gianna's never said that. I mean, if he thinks about me that way, that's quite an honor, because honestly, I think Gian's one of the most incredible people that I've ever met. And that's, you know, talk about the equipment being so important. The team that we have here is incredible and
very cohesive.
Well,
and talented.
Sometimes I kind of have to think, how the hell did I manage to meet the people that I met? You know, if I'd never met Gian, if I'd never met Matt, I'd met Zach or Jesse or Gordon, you know, like this wouldn't be the same operation that we have. And so, you know, we've got like Jesse and Gordon, two other people with master's degrees in brewing and distilling from Harriet Watt my same year.
Wow.
Gian, who's a former winemaker both in Paso and in Napa. Zach, who has a sommelier background. Matt has a business background, business economics. I actually met Matt, who was my business partner, in 2008, we were studying at the London School of Economics. So it's a very diverse group of guys, but they're also my friends. You know, like we all lived together for 2 years when we were building this, and the fact that we could live together and not kill each other, that says something, honestly. And I'm not closer to anybody else in the world, honestly. They're my family. Mm-hmm.
There's definitely a pattern emerging. There's some serendipitous occasions in your history. This gentleman that you met that took you under his wing initially when you were kind of trying to find yourself. First of all, the self-awareness is where it began in my mind when I listened to you talk about that level of dissatisfaction that you felt and the will to do something about it. You took deliberate steps and people came into your world that were synergistic. I don't think it's a coincidence. I think, you know, whatever you believe in, karma or... there's something at play here. There's definitely a pattern that emerges when, you know, as an observer, I listen to you describe your life's events. There's a sequence that's very powerful. And, of course, your business partner, your co-founder, plays an important role in, you know, the operational and structural part of it. And I know that you have very similar vision. But I know also from what you described that you are, in fact, behind the artistry to a large extent, the vision for the actual flavor of the product, and that's your favorite thing to do is to actually play with the still. So tell us about that.
So like you're talking about the recipe development process, and gosh, that was really involved. And the good thing is that we had a lot of time. So after I, you know, met with Matt and we formed this business, the first person I hired was Jesse Saunders out of my program in Scotland. And while we were building this distillery, which took us 3 years, by the way, from beginning of the idea to the time when we actually started distilling.
Wow. That's a huge commitment.
Oh, it is. And you know, a good year and a half of that, Jesse was doing recipe development. And basically what we did is we got him two liter lab scale setups, and we just started with this ridiculously long list of botanicals, like 150 different botanicals.
From around the world, really.
We literally went out and was like, all right, let's find everything that smells like something.
You know? That's a long list.
That isn't poisonous, that the FDA says we can use and stuff. And then Jesse went through and, you know, with the exception of a few that were obviously really bad smelling, went and did single distillate trials of all of them. Mm-hmm. We evaluated that. We narrowed it down to a list of about 50 botanicals then. And then we went and worked with a company called TC Bauer out of Chicago. And their wheelhouse is high-end perfuming, mostly perfuming and food industry sourcing botanicals. And we're like, all right, each of these botanicals, send us the best three or four examples that you can find, regardless of cost. Went through and did single distillate trials again, narrowed the list down, and then started with juniper, because we knew we wanted to use juniper in this, and then started layering on top of that. And the goal with this was not to beat you over the head with juniper or citrus or anything else. It was to be subtle, elegant, balanced. And so, you know, we ended up at the end of the day with 11 different botanicals from 10 different countries. And a hard, you know, point was figuring out when to stop. Because we were doing so many distillations, when was it good enough? And the point where we actually stopped is when we were trying to integrate citrus into this recipe. And we tried it every which way we could. And it just didn't work. Or it wasn't... I wouldn't say it didn't work, but it wasn't as good as it was without it. And that's where, like, this is brilliant as it is. This is where we're going to stop. The goal also wasn't to use 50 different botanicals in this either.
Sure.
The goal is to make the best gin that we possibly could. Mm-hmm. And that's, you know, what we ended up with. And then scaling up from 2 liters to 3,200 liters is also very difficult. It's not linear at all. And TC Bauer helped us out with that as well, because they do it with perfuming all the time. And they had this huge spreadsheet that they put everything in, and they spit out these numbers, and we did one trial distillation for the dry gin and nailed it first time.
Wow.
We didn't change a damn thing. And it was really cool to see actually how good of a proxy the lab scale stuff was for the large scale stuff. Yes, it's a lot more clean, it's a lot more refined off the big still, but in terms of just getting me a broad idea for recipe development, having a really good lab setup worked brilliantly.
You seem to have a knack early on to have developed the infrastructure that supports you know, your future success, both in scale and in thoughtfulness. And I mentioned in the beginning of the conversation that the distillery is located in Napa, and I was shocked to learn that you really didn't know much about the wine country. You just happened to pick this spot. Tell us why.
None of us, besides Jeff. Jeff is the one who manages the office and keeps us all in line. None of us had any connection to Napa at all. When I was developing the idea for this distillery, I wasn't going to do it in the UK. There are a lot of logistical reasons why I couldn't do it there, and also just reasons why I wouldn't want to personally. But I was looking to find the place where I could find the best oak in the world, or the best barrels in the world, because whiskey was originally what the first idea with this distillery. And I settled on Napa because we have more access to quality and variety of barrels here than anywhere else in the world. Yeah, it became our home. It was good for a lot of other reasons than just the barrels. But yeah, Napa's been amazing.
Now that you've made some friends and connections in the valley, and now it sounds like home.
Oh, it is our home. And we want to be kind of recognized as, you know, very much tied to the valley. You know, I want this to be our home and be identified with Napa.
Wow. Another serendipitous occasion. So why Locke and Union?
So a lot of times people think of it as a marriage of like Locke in Scotland and the Union in America. And it's kind of taken on a second meaning that way because everybody tends to think that that's what it is. But the actual truth of it is it's a reference to the campus at Harriet Watt in Scotland. And we had a lock on campus, which was actually really a pond, truth be told. But we called it the lock. And my dorm room looked out onto it, and I walked across the bridge to school every day. And then we had the student union on the bank of the lock, which is where a lot of the original ideas for this distillery were hashed out. And it was basically the two spots on campus that I identified the most with. And that's the name that we came up with. We, you know, we're coming up with a few other names before, and nothing really felt right. It didn't take long to come up with that name. You know, like we had tried a few before, but like when I was actually kind of ruminating about it, it didn't take long. And when I came up with a name, and I texted Matt, and he was like, "Yeah, that's perfect." And then we went through the whole process of getting the trademark issued, which was a whole other process in itself, and we actually got into a fight with the Scotch Whiskey Association over it. They didn't want us using Loch in our name because they think it's associated with Scotland. And initially they didn't want us using it with any of our spirits at all, which was kind of devastating because we were already pretty far along with our branding process.
Sure.
We lawyered up, came back at them. I don't think they were expecting that. We came to the agreement that we could use it on everything but whiskey.
How about that?
But we haven't given up our right to fight one in the future. So we'll see what's going to happen in, you know, a few years when the whiskey comes out. But
you fought for that.
Oh yeah, it was it was a really stressful time because we had already had the bottle design.
Sure.
And the it's a custom bottle.
And it's a beautiful bottle, by the way.
It has the crest on the back of it.
Yeah.
If we had to change things up, they actually came the last 2 days before they could actually have, you know, the objection period ended. They issued the objection to it. But
well, I'm glad you persevered because I'm looking at, really, it looks a lot like a perfume bottle, just a scale perfume bottle. It's very clean, very elegant. The aesthetics are definitely very pleasant.
We worked with a company called CF Napa for that, obviously in Napa. And before us, they hadn't done a ton of spirit projects. They did a few, but since us, that's become a much bigger part of their business. And they honestly just knocked it out of the park. Basically, what we wanted to do was you know, kind of capture an elegance that is reminiscent of being in Napa Valley in this bottle, without it being too overtly wine-ish.
Mm-hmm.
They were so... Okay, so with this whole process, I feel like we've run into so many good people that we've worked with that, you know, a major part of our success is not necessarily just us, it's the people that we've been able to surround ourselves with. Like TC Bauer is one, CF Napa is one, that, you know, and packaging is such a big part of how mm-hmm. people frame their perception of your business. Or your brand. So,
well, it's leadership, right? So leadership is surrounding yourself with people that make you look good and smart and attractive and good at math. I mean, no, seriously, it's a very important concept. You know, people tend to think of leaders as someone who do everything magically themselves and do everything perfectly. It's not that way at all. They capitalize on other people's talents and they get out of their way. And a lot of what you described is attracting the right talent and letting them run with it.
Well, I think if you are confident enough in what you're doing, you don't have, I mean, I'm not going to say I don't have an ego, that's wrong. But if you can surround yourself with other people and recognize that, yes, these people can do things that I can't do, that's a very important thing to realize.
Absolutely.
In other people. Like, nobody, no matter how smart or good they are, can do everything to make a business successful.
Agreed.
Nobody.
Join us again next week to hear the rest of this exciting interview with Colin Baker. Thanks again for tuning in to the official podcast of Palette Exposure featuring Ilona Thompson.